I'm Kathleen Holt. I'm here this morning with Jack Dunham, formerly of Copeland, now of Plains, and we're in Dodge City today at a relative's home. It's September 13th, 2014, about 9:30 in the morning. Jack, you want to start by telling us your name and your birth date and that sort of thing, and then we'll just get started.
My name is Dwight Dunham. I go by Jack, though. It's something that was pinned on me when I was first born. And I live in Plains, born and raised in Copeland. And like she said, I'm now in Dodge City with my mother-in-law's house. My whole name is Dwight John Dunham, rather than Jack. It was just a nickname that's pinned on me. And
what's your birth date?
Oh, June 21st in 1935.
Okay, good. I have to ask, what's the story of Jack? Was that a relative, or you just looked like a Jack when you were born? Or
I really can't tell you. They was going to name me first John Dwight. And at the time I was born, we lived on a farm south of Copeland. And my folks lived there, and my grandmother lived there, and there was three aunts that lived there, and an uncle. And when I was born, they decided that if I was going to be John Dwight, they was going to call me J.D., these aunts did. And my mother knew a fellow by the name of, that they called J.D., and she didn't like him.
Oh.
So she, when she made out the birth certificate, then she just turned the names around.
Oh.
But Dwight was named after, I was named after a friend of my dad's. And that's how I happen to know that. And then John is an old family name that's gone on for years. My granddad was John, and before him there was a couple other Johns. And but anyways, that was then when they kind of decided that it ought to be Jack. If Mom wasn't going to like J.D., well, it had to be Jack.
Oh, I see.
And these three sisters of Dad's, they were very, very dead set that I wasn't going to be called Dwight. I don't know why, but
they were looking out for you.
No, I guess. Yeah, so.
Wow. Well, let's fast forward to your military service. How is it that you joined the military?
I was going to be drafted because at that time there was draft. And I was told that if I would enlist, I could get to go into the branch of service that I wanted to go into. And so I went to Garden City, and there was a recruiter up there, and he gave me a whole spiel of stuff. And come to find out, most of it was not true. And but I wanted to go into what they called diesel engineering, which was a schooling to where you learned to be a mechanic on locomotives. And that's what I thought I wanted to do, and then I could work at the railroad when I got out. Well, when I went in to enlist, well, the guy said that he'd have to make sure that I could get into that particular area, and asked me to come back in a couple of weeks. And so I come back up again later, and he said, well, we can't get you into that right now. But he said, there will be openings, and you go ahead and enlist, go to basic training, and then we'll get you into the schooling when you get out of basic training. Well, that's the last I ever heard of that.
Wow.
And so they sent me to Georgia to go to a signal school down there and learn to operate diesel generators that would generate electricity for hospitals and so on. And so that's where I went. And I tried to get out of that and get back in diesel motives, but that didn't ever work. They couldn't even hear me, I think.
Wow.
with the IG and everybody else, and they said, well, you're just out of luck. We can't get you in there. So that's how I happened to get into that.
Wow. What other kind of fibs did he tell you?
Oh, he told me all kinds of things. He said, you can go basic training wherever you want to, and that wasn't true. I was not allowed to go. I went to Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, and was inducted there, and given an issue of clothing and so on. And then they loaded us on a bus and sent us to Camp Polk, Louisiana. Wow. And that was supposed to have been what they called the hell hole of the Army. Swamps. There was a swamp right next to our camp, and I never went in, but there was some of them that would go over to the PX, and then they'd get drunk and come back and try to get across that swamp and never make it.
Oh, wow.
Fall in it and then come on dirty and stinky. But when I finished up there with my basic training, the 13 weeks, then I went to Camp Gordon, Georgia. And that was the signal school where I went to that janitor school. I was there 8 weeks.
Sure.
And then I was shipped to Fort Knox, Kentucky. And they put me in charge of some generators that they had, they used in training, that these generators were supposed to have been out in the field and supplying electricity for radios and what have you that was being used out there. And they were training tank operators and gunners. And I went down there with that in mind, but when I got there, the generators wasn't any good. They wouldn't run. There was no way I could get them to run. And so I sent them off to get them fixed. And one day, the company commander came into my shop, and he asked me what I was doing. I told him nothing. I was just waiting on my generators. And he said, oh, you can't do that. He said, you got to have something to do. So he sent me up to the radio shop to drive a truck. And this truck was supposed to be just to go out and service radios on those tanks it was being trained in. And he told me to get in this truck and drive down there. So I went down and got a closed delivery van-type truck. And they set up a radio in the shop in the back end of that truck. And I was supposed to drive it out there, but they was going to take a man with me to do the repair work. Well, I decided that wasn't any good. I could do that any old time. So I was in for 3 years, so I'd make the best of it. So then I started putting in transfers to do overseas. I wanted to go to Germany. And every time I put one in, well, I'd come back unapproved. This company commander, he said, well, why don't you learn to work on radios, and you can work on them on that truck, and you don't have to have a guy along with you. So I did a little bit of work and learned how to do some work on the radios, and what they called first echelon work. And then got to sort of proficient enough to where I could work on them radios. Well, I was still trying to get out of there. I wanted to go overseas, and I wanted to go to Germany. And I wasn't able to make it. Every time I put in a transfer, they'd send it back. Well, finally, they sent one back and had orders for the Far East. That was in Korea. So I came home for leave before going over there, and I drove from home to Fresno, California, where my sister was living at the time, and she used to have a new baby, but she hadn't had it yet. So I went from their place. I took a train and went to Oh, now his name has skipped my mind. In Seattle, Washington, though. And so I was there about a week processing and getting all the shots that I need to go overseas. And they loaded us on a troop ship and sent us to Korea. Well, we got into a typhoon about 3 days out of Japan, and it was rough. And as fate would have it, they had assigned me to work in a mess hall on this ship that had dependents and officers on it. And just so happened, when I went in that day, there was a Negro cook that was the head of that particular department, and his name was Dunham. And he took a liking to me. And he said, don't go down there in that hole where all them guys are sick down there. He said, don't go down there. He said, I'll fix you up here. So he made me a pallet there to sleep on the floor of that mess hall. So yeah. I did that during the time that we was in that typhoon, which was, It was real rough. But we finally got out of that and got it back into, we went into Yokohama and went through a processing there again. And then they loaded us in a plane and flew us to, no, they didn't. They put us on a boat and sailed us over to the western edge of Korea near Seoul. And there we was unloaded from the ship and taken in land. Then I sat there in the processing center there waiting for an assignment because they didn't have no place for me to go, they said. And finally they said to go to what was called the 15th Aviation Group. And this aviation group, our main thing that we did was flew airplanes along the DMZ zone and take pictures of what the Koreans were doing on the other side of the DMZ zone. And then they'd report this back to 8th Army headquarters. And this was then kept in their records down there. We didn't know what was going on all that much. But we also had helicopters, and these helicopters were made to move officers and troopers from the line companies, what they call line companies, that was up next to the DMZ. We was back about 5 miles. And they would take them up into next to the DMZ. There was Koreans coming across that DMZ zone all the time. And we'd have to chase them back. And that was part of their job. And I was to maintain the radios in all that aircraft. And got to where I could do a pretty good job on that. But if there was something that was way beyond my control, I had to go to Seoul, to what they called the depot, and they'd repair the radios, and then we'd bring them back. So I did a lot of flying while I was over there, both fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters. And I had a company commander that was quite a proficient fellow with flying the fixed-wing aircraft, and he taught me how to fly. So I did a lot of flying while I was over there by myself, but I didn't get credit for it.
Oh, wow.
So I enjoyed flying. I always wanted to fly, but I never got to do it. But
was your first time?
Yeah.
Wow.
But then 13 months later, I was allowed to come back to the States. I still had 5 months left of the Army, and my active service anyway. And I was sent to Fort Sam Houston, Texas. And that was supposed to be the country club of the Army. That was really nice down there. It was a medical center where they train all the doctors and stuff, medical doctors. And so I didn't have a job to do there, so they put me in charge of medical instructions. And I had all kinds of charts and so on that they used in the classroom to teach these guys that are in medical training. And I just issued these charts out when the instructors come in to get them. And then I maintained an inventory of those all the time. And I had a couple of PFCs that worked under me. By that time, I'd gotten up to being what they call an E5 specialist. And I was the equivalent of a sergeant. Mm-hmm. But I had these two PFCs that worked under me, and they did most of the work. I didn't do much. I wasn't supposed to, so they said anyway. I finished out my 5 months there and got separated from the service, but I was still obligated for 3 years of reserve. Mm-hmm. And that's part of this information I've got here, that I didn't have to go active service since I'd served 3 years in the regular Army. I didn't have to go to the reserve meetings. And now, if you went in for 2 years, you had to serve with the active reserve.
Oh, okay.
But I didn't have to. And so then at the end of my career, they gave me a discharge. By that time, I was married and I had the fish to fry.
And then after, then what did you do next?
I went to work. I had worked before I went in the Army for my uncles in the drilling business, drilling irrigation wells. And when I come home, they wanted to quit that business and go into farming. And so they sold the company to me. And I went to the credit union in Montezuma and borrowed money to buy that company. And so I did that. It cost me $17,000.
Wow.
I bought that company, and I ran it for, let's see, that was in 61 when I bought it. And I ran it until, what was it? 65, I guess it was. I sold it to my brother. And then in 66, January 66, my wife and I started back to college. And
how'd that come about?
Well, I had allergies real bad, and I couldn't be around the farm that much. And in the fall of the year. And it wasn't fair because I had my brother in as a partner with me at that time, and it wasn't fair to him to go out and do all the work and me sit at the office. So I decided I'd let him have the company, and I wanted to go back and finish my degree anyway. And so that gave us an opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. And so we bought us a little old trailer house and moved to Hayes. That thing was built in the South, and it was real thin walls. January was cold. Water froze in the kitchen sink while we were in bed.
Oh, my gosh.
It was cold. Well, then we decided to get a different trailer, and so we traded it off and got one, a Northern-made trailer that was a little more decent to live
in. Yeah. And, so your wife went to work?
She went to work at... Well, she did a couple of jobs, and until she finally got on with the computers, and she was a key punch operator.
Oh.
And she made these cards. At that time, all the computers ran off a card, and she'd punch those cards. And then the computer took up a whole room. It was a big old thing. And... she did that until I finished my degree, and then we decided that both of us were going to stay and get our master's. Since I had this GI Bill, I could do that. And her dad told us, he said, now, if you'll do that, he said, I'll help you through that. Well, we were able to kind of keep it going ourselves. He didn't have to help us. But we did finish up our master's degree together there in 68. No.
And what was it in?
Mine was industrial arts and hers in business.
Oh.
And I was held that in mind at that time. I had wanted to be a draftsman. And I went first semester back in college. I took a semester of drafting. Well, it didn't take me long to figure out I didn't want to spend the rest of my life behind a drafting table. So I switched over to go into education. And so I finished up my degree with industrial education. And then we decided, the two of us, to get our master's. And so we went, both of us went into an area they called junior college curriculum. And we were with the idea that we'd teach in junior college.
Uh-huh.
Well, we found out real quick that I couldn't do that because I didn't have experience of teaching. And so, but anyways, I had a job offer in Leavenworth, Kansas, to go up there and teach. And I also had a job in Vaughan, New Mexico.
Wow.
What a place. She was pregnant at the time, and we asked about a doctor down there in a hospital. He said, well, you can go either way you want to go for 100 miles. There we were, out there in the middle of no place.
Oh.
Well, we weren't going to do that. So then we got an offer from Leavenworth, Kansas, and I went up there and interviewed for that job, and they sent me a contract to teach. But in the meantime, we'd come home, was it for Easter?
Mm-hmm.
And we saw in the paper there was an opening in Kismet at the Southwestern Heights High School. So we called the superintendent, and he set us up for an interview, and we went down there. And they said, well, they'd let us know. So I come back, went back to school that weekend, and on Monday morning, the head of the department called me, and he said, I got a note from your superintendent. I said, I don't have no superintendent. He said, you do now?
Oh, wow.
They hired me, and so that's where I went, and I spent the rest of my teaching career there.
Wow.
Taught 26 years of active teaching, and then I did 4 years of substitute teaching. But in that 4 years, I'd found out that I could count my service record toward my retirement.
Oh.
So with 3 years active service, I could count full time on that. 3 years of inactive service, I could get 1 year credit for that. So it gave me 4 years added to my 26, so I could retire at 30 years.
Wow.
So
wow.
That's what I did.
Would you say the GI Bill was instrumental in that?
A lot of it.
Yeah.
It was instrumental in the master's degree.
Yeah.
And because it made things available to me that it wouldn't have been otherwise.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting that you took such a long way around, but you ended up almost back at home? Because how far between Copeland and Plains?
22 miles.
Yeah. That's remarkable.
We stayed right there. They said that was rather unusual for you to come back that close to home, but I had a friend that told me, said, that was the superintendent, and he told me, he said, no, I said, that's not unusual. Said that a lot of people come back as close as they can get to home.
Well, I want to come back and flesh some of this out.
Okay.
Tell me about, had you traveled out of Kansas before you took that first trip off to Arkansas?
Not really. No.
So what was that like? I mean, had you been on the train and stuff?
That was an experience. They flew us to Arkansas and got us down there, and that wasn't so bad, other than it was raining the whole time we was down there, and wet. It was terrible, messy. And we stayed in the barracks most all the time because it was too wet to be outside. And then they just loaded us on a bus and took us to Camp Polk, Louisiana. And that was terrible down there, that June, July, and August, and it was hot, that tight. We hit a hurricane one time while I was down there. And that lasted about a week. And I got heat strokes twice. And I'd pass out in rank and have to get doctored up again. So I got to where I didn't have to march any. Every time they go on a march somewhere, they load me in the truck.
I bet with your allergies, that
terrible time.
Kind of damp and...
Yeah. The humidity, you know, is about 90% or better. And when I got out of there, I went to Louisiana, and it was or Georgia, and it wasn't much better, you know, as far as moisture is concerned. And that was in November. Went down there, and I was there for till June, or till December, rather. And finishing up about 8 weeks of training there. Then I went to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and that wasn't bad. That was pretty good duty down there. So weather was pretty good.
What was the food like?
Not real bad. When was in Louisiana, our cooks cooked on coal stoves. And the worst part thing about that was at the end of the meal, we had to go in and clean out the inside of those stoves where the soot was. And that was a horrible, horrible duty. I just hated that. But the food wasn't all that bad. In Korea, we drew real good food because the biggest majority of the people in our company that I was assigned to were officers. And they drew better meat and so on for the rations than they did enlisted guys. And so we got real good food over there. But we didn't have call to put any KP duty over there. The Koreans did all of this, the civilian Koreans. And so we didn't have to do that. We stayed.
Was it Asian food or they
no?
Cook
it was American food. We still had the guys in charge of the mess hall were still the American soldiers, but they fixed food the way the Americans
they wanted to.
Yeah, it was good food.
So I'm curious to know, first time on a ship when you took off from Seattle?
Oh, horrible. Before the ship ever started out, there was guys hanging over the edge of the rail picking up their guts because it was making them seasick already. They weren't.
Yeah. That must have been something. I think about a cans.
Yeah,
and
I never did get sick.
Oh.
I don't know, there's something about it that it didn't bother me that much.
Lucky.
Yeah, I was lucky. Now, it would have been if I'd have been down there in that hole on that ship when that typhoon came along.
Yeah.
But because there were so many people sick down there and it stunk to high heavens. But I didn't have to be down there, so.
Yeah.
She's got her guard duty.
You pulled guard duty?
Oh, yeah. When I was in Korea, we had a high fence around our compound where we kept our aircraft and so on. And there was always tools and things like that. And them Koreans wanted that stuff.
Oh.
And we pulled guard duty, walking guard duty at night, and to keep the see catch Koreans as coming in. And I never got an opportunity to do it, but there was a number of them that did get caught, and they were, I don't know whether they jailed them or what they did with them, but the story was, I don't know if it's actually true or not, that if you shot one of them, that you got a carton of cigarettes and $2 and shipped to a different company. So that they wouldn't process through it.
Right.
Catch you. So I don't know whether they ever did or not. I wasn't in on it, so.
Did everybody smoke?
Oh, yeah, most everybody.
Yeah.
And I did at the time, but after I got out, I quit. But after we got married.
Good influence.
She told me, she said, you don't know how bad you smell and make us smell. Well, I didn't. But one morning I woke up, there's a guy beating on the door to fix a dry shaft for him for an irrigation well. And I didn't have any cigarettes. I'd had to go downtown to get some, and I decided I didn't need them right then. So I went over and worked on this man's shaft for him and got him going. And then we went to church, and as a result of the day going as it was, well, I'd gone all day without a cigarette, and I thought, well, shoot, if I can get along one day without one, well, surely I can quit it. So I just quit.
Wow.
Was able to stay cured.
So. Wow, that's good. So you didn't know Jacqueline when you were in, then were you already dating or?
Oh, we'd known each other all our lives, really.
Okay.
Her dad and my dad were buddies and run around together before either one of them were married.
Oh, okay.
They only lived 4 miles apart. And so it wasn't really a, what would you call it? There was no formal introduction because we had known each other for a long time. But we never dated at all in high school. And she went her way to college and I went my way. I dated her good friend and she dated my good friend. You know, we never got together that way. And then after I come home from service, my drilling business, we had a calendar that we handed out every year, and everybody liked those calendars. And she was working then at the time for Panhandle Eastern in Liberal, and she come home one weekend and wanted one of them calendars. So she come by the shop, and I gave her one, and just for something to do, I asked her to go to the show with me. And so one thing led to another.
I see.
Then I've got an aunt that was a school teacher, and she was Jacqueline's third and fourth grade teacher. And she always said that she thought I ought to go with Jacqueline.
Oh, she had you fixed up, huh?
Yeah, she thought she did.
And, yeah.
But, yeah, one thing that led to another, the next thing we knew, we got married. So.
Yeah. Tell me about what it was like being that far away from home with your family. How'd you communicate?
It was pretty eye-opening to start with. When I was in basic training, my only sister got married while I was down there. And of course, I couldn't come home for the wedding. And that was a long old day, knowing what was going on at home. Then when I went to Korea, why, my brother, just younger than me, decided to get married, and I couldn't come home for the wedding. And my grandmother died, and I couldn't come home for that. Mm-hmm. And that made a pretty long stretch out of that. I just didn't feel good at all about all that. But I lived through it.
Mm-hmm. So, did you communicate mostly by mail?
Mostly, yeah. While I was in Korea, they gave us what we call an R&R. And we was able to go to Japan and spend a week or so there. And just kind of, R&R stood for relax and recuperation. And so I went over there 1 week, spent a week in Tokyo. And while I was over there, I telephoned home.
Oh.
And talked to my brother and so on. My brother and I were real close at the time. We worked together then later in the drilling business.
Mm-hmm.
So
I bet that was hard. Was that hard to hear his voice?
Oh, yeah.
Hear his voice?
Yeah. But I enjoyed the visit with him. I was allowed only 3 minutes. And so that was on some kind of a telephone deal. I don't know just what it was. But it was military. They paid for it. I didn't have to pay for the phone call. But they allowed us that much time to talk to our family, so.
Wow. boy, you think about email today or Skype or whatever. Yeah.
The first month I was over there, I told you my sister was pregnant when I went to Fresno that time. And I found out that the baby was born the day after I sailed from Seattle.
Wow.
And so there was a year before I got to see my first nephew or niece.
Yeah.
Of course, I had another brother that got married, and he had a little boy at the same time. And just about a month, I guess, after the little girl was born, my niece. And when I came home from overseas, though, them two kids was walking by then, and they were in mother's cabinets unloading everything.
Oh.
I had quite a time with those kids. That was something, you know, come home and wrestle around with those little guys.
Wow. What was it like coming home?
You know, that was a different experience, too. Since I was a E-5 sergeant, I could fly home. So they load us in an airplane, and this was in December, and it's cold and damp and dirty and so on. And they, it was one of them old cargo planes, and they had equipment underneath, and we just was in the upper deck of that plane. And they took off, and all of a sudden they threw the brakes to that thing and turned it around. They didn't have enough speed. So went back and hit the runway again, and they railed her up again, and here we go. And that old plane, there was no lining inside. It was just shell on the outside and rattling and rumbling. But anyway, we finally got off the ground and went into Yokohama, and we were to board there an airplane to fly us on home. And we got there, and it was iced in. I couldn't fly out, so we sat there for 2 days just waiting on an airplane to fly. And they load us on this, it was a civilian airplane, and a big four-engine job. And we flew from Yokohama then to Wake Island. We were all in winter clothes, you know, bundled up, cold. Well, it ended on Wake Island. Of course, the guys come out to service the airplane in Bermuda shorts.
Oh.
We got off that airplane, and they told us to leave our coats on the airplane.
Cause oh, wow.
It was just too hot. And it was hot. And then our next stop was in Honolulu, Hawaii. But we was only there just long enough to go through what they call customs. And they probably, I don't know, we may be there 2 hours. But we didn't get out of the air terminal. They loaded us on another plane, then we flew us on to San Francisco, and that's where we landed here. And then I flew on home to Garden City, got in there. And, different experiences.
And who met you at the airport?
My brother. Mm-hmm. That was kind of a deal. I called home and told him I was coming in and what time I'd be there. But they didn't get what city I was coming into. So one of my brothers come to Garden City to meet the plane, and the other come to Dodge City to meet the plane.
Oh.
But I flew into Garden City and then come on home. They didn't know where I was at.
They have a big celebration?
No, not really. It was about Christmas time, because, see, when I got home, I think it was the 17th or 18th of December, and it was Christmas time, and all the kids was coming home anyway. So it was kind of a celebration. At that time, my parents had moved in to take care of my granddad, and because grandmother was dead, he needed somebody to watch after him. So they moved in there, and so I stayed there with them until we got married, which was about 2 years, 3 years, 2 years, I guess.
Okay, back up again to R&R in Japan. How'd you get around with the language and stuff like that?
Well, that wasn't any problem. And people over there was teaching, they had enough English to where you could talk to them.
Uh-huh.
And transportation-wise, so we just call a taxi, and them taxis, the town was all laid out with railroads through town. You know, that was the way they got around before the war. And so there's tracks literally all over everywhere, and we'd go in every direction. And these taxis over there was Jeeps, ex-military Jeeps. And they'd load you in that thing, and they'd just take off. And we had a guy with us, and he was in a hurry to get somewhere, go somewhere. And he told that driver, he said, he said, bolly, bolly, meant hurry.
Oh.
So, I mean, that driver took off, and he'd go through those intersections where those tracks go like this, and that Jeep, of course, was following them tracks. I didn't know whether it was ever going. It was kind of scary, but we finally got there. Got to where we were going anyway.
So did you eat Japanese food then?
Yeah, we did some, but we were in what they called the Kashini Barracks, and that was a military place where we could stay.
Uh-huh.
And they had KP food over there, and so we ate there most of the time, but when we'd go out in an evening and go to shows and stuff like that, we'd eat Japanese food.
Uh-huh.
That was kind of different.
And what kind of shows?
Oh, they were mostly girls singing and things like that. It wasn't
mm-hmm.
wasn't a movie or anything, but
yeah.
There was those, you know, type things.
Was there any kind of entertainment like that, like television or movies at that time back in Korea?
Well, yeah, at Korea, we had the USO people come by every once in a while. And we had television, but it wasn't any good. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't hardly see it. But, yeah, the USO would come by every once in a while and show. It had some gals singing and some other things.
Mm-hmm.
But, and we got movies all the time over there. And during the time that I was there, well, I run the movie projector, showing the movies each night. And so we were entertained enough.
Mm-hmm. How real was the war? Were there injured people there, or coming and going, or cycled through, or you were kind of behind all that?
Yeah, we were pretty much behind that. There were times, however, while we were there, that some of those Koreans had come across the DMZ zone, and they'd load us up and send us out of our company compound, send us down to Seoul on an abandoned airbase down there, and we'd set up a temporary base down there, and stay there until things cooled down, and then we'd come back.
Oh.
But our company was an abandoned airfield over there that was, it was made out by the Koreans to start with, but then we got attached to us, and we stayed there.
Uh-huh. Any particularly rememberable stories or events or things that happened that you told the stories of?
Well, I know one time, and this was kind of a scary experience for me. I'd never flown in a helicopter. And these helicopters were very temperamental as far as the radio concerned, because sometimes they worked, sometimes they didn't. And so this one helicopter was not working right when the guy was flying. It worked fine on the ground. So he wanted me to go with him, and he'd show me what it was doing. Well, I got in that thing, and it's got just nothing but a glass bubble in front of you, and you're strapped in that seat, and that monkey decided he'd take off. Why, he just raised that up off the ground and slid it over sideways to when it got above the runway. And then he just tipped that thing up like that. And there I was looking right into that concrete runway. And all that I thought you were going to dump me right there on my nose.
My stomach just turned over. Oh,
it did me too, I tell you for sure. But I made it in, made it, got up in the air, and then I figured out what's wrong with the airplane. But they took me back then, and I fixed what was wrong with it. But that was a real scary experience. And then another time, we were flying up there, and this guy said, "Did you ever ride in one of these in what they called an auto rotation?" And what this was, when the plane faltered and an engine failed, well, you could turn the props backwards, and they'd turn and let the plane down easy-like. And I told him, of course, I had never done that. And he said, well, we're going to have fun here. And there was an old papa-son down on the rice paddy loading rice straw on his cow. And so this Lieutenant Lipinski was flying, and he shut that thing down and turned the props the other way. And, of course, when he did that way, he just made a horrible sound. And when he did, that old cow down there got spooked, and she took off and run right out from underneath her thing that she had on her back with it, piling the straw. You know, made that old pop song mad as fuck. But he put the power to it then, of course, and pulled it out of it.
Wow.
But that was another scare, you know, falling out of the sky, and I didn't know whether he's going to be able to get that thing going again or not. But he finally did.
Wow.
We had all kinds of experiences over there. One time, the kitchen caught fire. They decided they was going to get the fire department in there. Well, the fire department was clear down the road. It wasn't anywhere near us. And by the time they got up there to us, we had it all put out. But some of us guys started bailing water and what have you. We was able to get it put out before it did it. An awful lot of damage. Most of the buildings at that time, then, after we took over that airbase, were stone mason buildings. They're made out of cinder blocks and so on. So there wasn't much to burn to them anyway. Yeah. If it had been bad, but now as far as sleeping quarters, we slept in what they called, we called them hooches. They were little round top buildings, but they're only about 20 foot wide, or maybe a little wider, and then long. They stretch out for a couple hundred feet, and with 9 bunks on each side. And in the wintertime, it's colder than Dickens, and they had stoves that set, oil-type stoves that set 3 or 4 different, depending on the length of the building. So we had to keep warm that way. But I woke up one night. I had my sleeping bag unfolded and on top of my blankets to try to keep warm. And when I woke up the next morning, there was snow on my blankets and stuff.
Wow.
So it was cold. Man, it got cold over there.
Wow.
But the buildings was not tight enough to keep snow out of them.
Yeah. Were you issued just the standard wool blankets, or did you get extras?
Those Army wranglets.
Yeah.
They were issued, each of us 2 of them, but that wasn't enough.
Jack, let's go back to when you got to Korea. What were your first impressions?
Horrible. They loaded us on little ships to bring us from the big ship onto land. And then when we got up there, well, they put us in trucks to take us to the processing center where we would be distributed out to where different places. And it's cold in the Dickens, close to Christmas time in December. And these trucks had tarps over the back end of them so you couldn't see out. Well, I had to see what was going on, so I pulled a tarp back and looked out. My first scene was a papasan with his little horse in a cart in the middle of an intersection, and he was urinating out in the middle of the intersection.
Wow.
That was an eye-opener. It really was. But I could smell it just, well, before we even got on the land, you could smell it. Oh, it's a terrible smell around there. And always was. My clothes, even when I got home from Korea, my clothes were all smelling. And Mother just couldn't stand it. She had to do her laundry.
Did it launder out? Why did it smell so
bad? It would eventually, yeah, but it stayed in there a while.
What was it from?
From what, that human waste, mainly. And it just a horrible smell.
It was the sewer system?
So. Yeah. Well, it wasn't a sewer system, really. Because the human waste from the bathrooms that we had on post, they were a hollow underneath, and them guys in their buckets and just dip that stuff out and carry it off. And a little later on, we finally got some nice restrooms which had showers in them and so on, which didn't do that anymore. And they had lagoons off to take care of it. But the people went out there in them lagoons and dip it out of there and take it.
Yeah. So they used it for what?
Fertilizer and rice paddies.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So it was just in the environment.
Oh, yeah.
Huh. So you had, were the latrines like outhouses then?
Yeah, some later on they were. I'd start with they weren't really, but later on, I don't know, we was there probably 3 or 4 months before they finally got those nicer restrooms.
What was the shower like then?
Well, when we first got over there, there was nothing but a tent with a wooden floor in it. And you went in there and like they have on MASH.
Uh-huh.
And then when we got this newer place, well, then we had regular showers in.
Oh.
And, but we always wore, you call them flip-flops now. We always wore those in there because the fungus and so on were pretty bad, so we tried to keep from getting our athlete's foot and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So kept them on.
How'd you learn about all that stuff? I mean, was that part of your basic training? Did you have special training for going to Korea?
No, really not. We just got over there. It was an eye opener. You know, you learn it by being there. And, no, we weren't trained at all for that.
Wow. What'd you notice? I mean, I'm thinking, okay, you're maybe a year away from being on a farm in Kansas, and then all of a sudden one day you're in Korea. What was the life like? What were the cities like?
There wasn't much city life over there. We had our compound where we stayed and worked was just an airstrip, and then on the other side of the road, there was a road that ran through it they called the MSR, which was a military supply route. And on the other side, there was where we stayed. Aircraft and everything is kept on one side. But nearly every time there's a place like that around, those Koreans built buildings right around it, and they'd have little villages right around there. And so they were right there next to us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Those people you didn't need to worry about because they were not North Koreans, they were South Koreans. And they welcomed you there. And a lot of them worked on the base. They did janitorial work and cooks and all kinds of stuff. Laundry ladies, you're talking about those. They'd take your laundry and you give it to them, and they take it out and wash it at the creek and beat it on stones and clean it up. It was hard on your clothes, but boy, they got them clean.
Wow.
And then they starch them to where they you couldn't get your leg in the pants because they stuck together.
Really?
You had to split them open to get, get your leg down in there. But they were really starched to perfection.
And wow.
It cost you a carton of cigarettes a month, and they wanted Viceroy cigarettes because they were more valuable on the black market.
Viceroy.
Viceroy, yeah. That was a kind of a mentholated cigarette.
Were they American made?
Yeah.
What about candy and stuff like that?
Well,
did you?
We had a little PX there, and you could get things like that on that PX. But if we bought it, generally we give it to the little Korean kids because they all wanted it. And so we usually give it to them. And we had one little Korean boy that stayed with us all the time. And we called him Johnny. Of course, I think there was about a couple thousand Johnnies around. But this little kid was an orphan, and he just kind of took up with us and stayed with us all the time. But he'd let them kids on in the villages know that there was candy available. And so they'd come around begging for candy all the time. And of course, anytime you're around a place like that, you've always got the business girls around there, too. And when we changed from walking over in our area where we stayed across the MSR to work, those business girls were out there on the street campaigning and what have you. So, but they tell you there's, you know, love with you and all that kind of stuff. We just got to where you had to ignore it. If you didn't, why, they'd just pester the devil out of you.
What about the little kids? What happened to that orphan kid?
You know, I don't know what happened to him. He stayed there all the time I was there. And he'd helped around, did different errands and stuff for different GIs. And he generally had somebody that he more or less stayed with. But the other little kids, they had to stay off of them. The military base, they couldn't come on. They catch you, though, when you cross the road and go down to work. And that's when they wanted their candy and stuff. But poor little old guys, usually the real little ones that was just getting where they could walk good didn't wear anything from their waist down. They'd have a T-shirt on, maybe, but they didn't have any underwear. And they just went naked underneath. And if they needed to go, they go. And in the wintertime, that was kind of a funny thing. They had little shops around. You could buy all kinds of trinkets and stuff. But those Koreans, they had a table that was set there in front of the shop. And they had a blanket that went around and covered the underneath side of that thing. Then they build a fire underneath that table. And they keep the fire down, of course, but that kept it warm. They crawl up to that table and put their legs underneath there. And that's, that was kind of a way to keep it warm.
Wow. So was there a lot of evidence of the war? I mean, how were the South Koreans faring in that war climate?
By the time I got there, they weren't too bad. There was a lot of evidence of destruction and so on. You know, buildings just partially there and stuff like that. But Koreans were doing fairly well. But they're still primitive as all get out. There was their houses. They would be built on a platform above the ground, and they heated that house by putting fire underneath the floor. And the house was made out of twigs and mud. And there wasn't anything that was a wooden structure over in the villages. Now, we had pretty decent buildings out there.
Wow. Okay, so tell me about your career. How'd you make your rank?
Well, when you go in as a buck private. And we were paid accordingly. You didn't have any rank. You didn't have any privileges much to speak of. And then you told me he's in there. Well, just as when you finished basic training, well, then you was promoted to what they called a PFC, Private First Class, and you got one stripe. And that was just automatic. But then from then on, it depended on what you were doing, what the demand was for that particular job, and so on, so that you could make rank from that. And they more or less give it to you if you had earned it. And after you got up to be about an E4, well, then you need to take a test. They had a test for you. But when I got over there, I was a PFC when I got there. And I was a PFC for quite a little while. And then the company commander called me in one day and told me my job called for an E5, which was a sergeant. But he said, I can't give you that because you haven't been through the E4 yet. So I went through the E4, which was, they called it a Specialist 4. And I was that for about, I wasn't that very long. No, went on R&R, and when I came back, well, they decided I ought to be an E5. So when I got back, I had a new rank waiting on me. So I got in. I got promoted up from that, and then I never got it yet. Not got out of that before, except with this, what I was called proficiency pay. You could take a test on what you were doing. If you scored well enough on that test, they'd give you another, I think it was $100 a month. And so I took that test. I didn't know what I was doing, but I took it and passed it. So I got the extra money.
Oh, good. Good.
When I went in, I was getting $78 a month. And when I got out, I was making a little over $300 a month, which was, I was living pretty good then.
Good pay, huh?
Yeah.
Did you get any kind of, like, overseas bonus? Yeah,
it wasn't really a bonus, just overseas pay, they called it. And it was a little more, but it wasn't all that much. I think during the time that I was over there, I think it was only like $20-$25 a month or something like that. I don't remember now for sure.
Did it take all that to live on, or did send any home?
The time you buy your own smoke and do your laundries and and any entertainment you wanted, well, you had to pay for that out of that.
Yeah.
So you had to kind of watch your dollars, but it wasn't all that bad.
Did you get care packages from home?
Oh, yeah. My mother was real good about sending stuff over there.
Yeah.
And some of the stuff wasn't any good after you got there. You know, she'd send a box of cookies over there that was nothing but crumbs when you got there because the handles were rough.
Yeah.
But
I bet you ate them anyway.
Well, we did. With a spoon.
That's cool. What was it like having your first Christmas over there by yourself?
Oh, it's pretty lonesome.
Yeah.
Pretty lonesome. No family. Of course, he was just the same as everybody. You know, nobody was home, and everybody wanted to be home, but it just wasn't possible. They couldn't send us home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was pretty lonesome.
Yeah, I imagine not being able to make phone calls and contacts. Yeah. Letters. Did you write letters on?
Oh, yeah. I wrote pretty near every night. I'd write to somebody, you know. Particularly my folks. And then I wrote to my sister. At that time, she was living in Fresno. And then I had an aunt in Denver that I wrote to quite a little bit. Another in Pueblo. I wrote to her quite a bit. But I had a cousin that was, he was in the Air Force stationed in France. And I wrote to him occasionally, too.
Any surprises, any, like, kind of odd circumstance? You bump into anybody you knew or anything like that over that time?
I don't remember anybody I bumped into over in Korea other than I was stationed with the company I was in. My best buddy was from Jetmore.
Oh, really?
And we wound up getting together after we got out of the service in quite a bit. And he was kind of a cowboy guy. His folks had a ranch up there, but they separated while we were over there. And when he come home, though, his mother had gotten most of that ranch and she squandered it off.
Oh.
He never had much after that. He tried, but he just couldn't make it.
Did you maintain contact with any people from that time?
Not really. I don't recall now that I did.
Alex.
Well, that's when I was stationed in Texas. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the PFC that worked with me in that training aides area, his name is Alex Hamilton, and I made an acquaintance with him afterwards. We got out. He come by to see us one time in Plains, and but that's the only one I can recall right now, mm-hmm. other than the mm-hmm. boy at Jetmore.
Mm-hmm. So, were you active in veterans groups?
Yeah, when I got out of the service, I joined the American Legion in Copeland, and I belonged to that until we went to college, and I dropped out because I just couldn't afford all that, and so I dropped out of it then, and then I didn't join again they didn't have any active service there in Plains, so I never joined up back up with them again. But then when we started coming to Dodge, there were folks living up here, and then I joined the VFW out here.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, that's kind of a funny thing. They had dates set up when you could join the American Legion. And according to my service, I couldn't belong because I wasn't in service at the right time. They had a vacant spot between the Korean War and Vietnam War that you weren't eligible to join it. And I thought that was kind of funny. But fellow down at Plains, he was a member of the American Legion, but he was active over at Meade. And he told me, he said, if you put in an application to join, but he said, don't put your years of service down. He said, I'll get you in. Well, I thought that's a long shot.
Yeah.
He did. He got me.
Wow.
So I'm now an active member in the American Legion as well as the BFW.
Huh. That's interesting. How about summing up your whole experience when you think about your life overall? Where does this fit in and what?
Well, as far as my service life is concerned, I really didn't care for that much. I didn't enjoy it all that much either. But yet, the experiences that I had while I was in there, I wouldn't hardly trade for anything. You know, they were worth quite a bit, and my memories come back from a lot of that. And I really, really think it was worthwhile. But even though it was 3 years more or less wasted, but because I didn't do all that much. And like I say, it was kind of an experience.
Mm-hmm. And a greater appreciation for America.
Oh, yeah. Make you really loyal to the country here.
Mm-hmm.
And the best part is right here in Southwest Kansas, you know. I've never been any place in all of my travels and so on like that. I'd still come back to Southwest Kansas.
Have you ever been back to Korea?
No.
Japan? Ever wanted to?
Oh, I wondered sometime about going back over there, but I don't know why. There's nothing over there for me. Mm-hmm. And what was there then is not there now.
Right.
And so I don't think I'd care anything about going back that much.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to sometime go back to Hawaii because I wasn't there long enough to enjoy any of it. But she says she don't want to go back, so.
No.
She's been over there. I have.
Oh.
I just thought I was there that one night.
Yeah.
And it was late at night when we were there, and there wasn't much going on, so.
Tried to talk you into staying in the service.
Oh, did they?
Tried to talk you into staying in the service.
Oh, yeah. Major down there in Sam Houston, Texas, he wanted me to stay. He said, if you go with me, he was a doctor. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you go with me, he was being reassigned to the big army hospital in Virginia, Maryland.
Walter Reed?
No, or I think it was Walter Reed.
Bethesda?
I believe it was. He was being reassigned there, and he said, if you'll come re-enlist and come with me down there and be my standby generator operator, because they had to have a generator, you know, to work in case power went off there. He said, if you do that, he said, I'll guarantee you by the time you finish your enlistment of 6 years, he said, I'll have you at the top rank of the enlisted men, which had been an E-9. And that's a, well, sergeant major, really. And but you'd have been in a specialist class, but I don't know what I'd be in. But I'd had enough of it by then. And I'd had that offer to buy that drilling business, and so I decided I'd come home and do that.
Yeah. In all that time, you did you ever get time to come back to visit?
Oh, yeah, I was home. Well, I spent a week at home right after basic training. And then while I was in Fort Knox, I came home for Christmas. And then after I was being shipped overseas, well, I came home for about, I think it was 3 weeks before I went on overseas.
Uh-huh.
And then when I come back, I was home about a month before I had to show up in San Antonio. And so I got several times to come home.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You had to, that was on your own expense, and so you had to save money to get to be able to do that. If you didn't save your money, you couldn't come home.
Oh yeah.
You didn't have no way.
How'd you get here?
How'd you get?
And did you drive? Did you train?
Well,
fly?
I had a drive when I was in San Antonio, Texas. I had a car down there. And I had one when I was in Fort Knox, Kentucky, too. But I didn't. Well, I took one down when I was in Georgia. I took a car down, but I couldn't keep it there. And so I had a friend that was in Valdosta, to Florida in the Air Force. And he had leave coming, and so he brought my car back home. And so I didn't have one then the rest of the time. But it was just as well that was so horrible down there. And it was a convertible car.
Oh.
And the canvas top just went pop down there, you
yeah.
know, because of the moisture.
Yeah.
I had a nice pair of floor shine shoes in the trunk of the car, and I went out to get them out one day, and they're just full of green mold.
Oh, my gosh.
They ruined them shoes.
Goodness. Any other thoughts we didn't cover?
Well, I can't think right now. Probably think of something tomorrow.
All right. Well, you give us a call. We'll be back. All right. Thank you so much.